This is the No Dogma Podcast. I'm Brian Hogan, and this evening I'm joined by Steve Elmore, president of Disbelief, a gaming company that focuses on engineering based in Cambridge, just outside Boston. Thank you very much for taking time out of your evening, Steve.
No problem. Happy to do it.
Does it start? Can you just tell me about yourself?
Yeah, so I'm what they call a games industry veteran. I've been doing this my whole career. I've been in the games industry for 20 years now, and I've just always been passionate about games and making games. And even before I did it professionally, I did it sort of for personal development reasons. I think the first game I wrote was when I was like 10 years old or something like that.
What language?
Back then it was BASIC.
Now we're
C++ all the way.
What was your first professional game?
My first professional game was actually, so I worked at a localization company in Europe. So what a localization company does is takes a game in US English and changes the language, changes the audio, changes the text for the European market. So we did a game that was from US English to French, German, Italian, and Spanish.
But you weren't involved in the gaming as such. It was the text, maybe some of the images, bits and pieces like that.
Yeah, it was a great job because we worked not only with other programmers, but with the translators too. And so they would consult about not only like the language that needs to be changed, but also cultural significance. Oh. That might not translate in the game. And so, yeah, the whole job was to take a game that was already made, extract the assets, figure out what works and what doesn't work in the target culture, re-record new assets and manufacture new assets, and then rebuild the game in a way that you can choose the language when you start up.
And more recently, are there some games that people might know?
Most recently, I worked on Gears of War 4 with Microsoft. And obviously that's the fourth in a series of games, and I think there were some unnumbered versions in there as well. And that's kind of the other end of the scale to where I started in the games industry. That's the type of game that's kind of like a movie production in scale. It requires hundreds of people to put together.
And that was within your role at Disbelief.
Yes, that's correct.
So let's talk a little bit about Disbelief.
Okay, so Disbelief is a company that we formed. So it's a group of engineers, and we are, I guess the thing that gets us out of bed is not so much the creative side of games. It's more, we're passionate about the technology that goes into making games. A lot of what we focus on is things like performance, memory, and frame rate optimization, and then console hardware and graphics and all of the low level stuff. In a lot of ways, if we do our job correctly, you don't notice that we've done it because the game doesn't crash and it doesn't disconnect from the network and it runs smoothly. And that's kind of what gets us out of bed in the morning.
And is that something that these games companies don't want to do for themselves, or is it that the developers are more focused on the mechanic of the game? Like why are you needed by the likes of a Microsoft?
Yeah, so I think it is different with every customer. I think for a company like Microsoft, they have a vast array of really talented engineers, and so all we're really doing is adding a tiny bit of extra bandwidth to their development effort. But they're one of our biggest customers. On the smaller scale, we work with teams that don't even have programmers. Now you can get engines like Unity and Unreal, which are functional sort of out of the box, and you can make games with those. It's possible for a team to exist that doesn't have any programmers. And so in those cases, what we do is maybe make something possible that's not possible out of the box, you know, add a feature that the software doesn't support or something like that.
But the person coming to you is making the game. They're not just handing you the design, but you're coming in and then helping them with something that's more complicated beyond their ability.
Yeah, our company doesn't do any creative or art content or anything like that. So usually we kind of define ourselves as we help people ship their games.
Okay, and then that kind of gets me to the question of, do you make your games, any games at all, yourselves?
No, our role on various different games varies. Like I said, if we're working with Microsoft, we're really just adding engineering bandwidth. If you're working with a team that doesn't have any technical people, then we can kind of come in and revolutionize what they can do. So our role is sometimes extra bandwidth. It's sometimes giving technical direction and letting the customer know what's going to work and what's not going to work.
A little bit later, we'll come back to disbelief and some of the engineering challenges you face. But what we're going to talk mostly about for the rest of the podcast is the things that differentiate making games from other more general software engineering. So in my world, I'm doing mostly websites and occasionally desktop apps. Very easy, very straightforward. Why are games different?
Yeah, games is a pretty interesting field. I mean, essentially what you're working on is a piece of art. It has to have compelling content, and the exact definition of what compelling is or what fun is this very like black magic type of area. I don't think it's possible to define what makes a good game or what makes a bad game. And so ultimately, like, the whole thing is a creative endeavor, but there's a lot of software engineering underneath the hood to make it operate. So it's kind of like if you imagine a piece of art that's a sculpture, but it can move, then we are the skeleton underneath the surface. But everything you see has got to be aesthetically pleasing, and it's got to function.
And as a software engineer on gaming, do you then need to develop that aesthetic? Because I have no aesthetics with regard to my software development. How different does it have to be for a gaming engineer?
A lot of the time, in terms of supporting the creative work, it's exactly that. It's a support role. So there are people who provide creative input, who provide art, who provide audio, who provide the sort of the vision for the game. And our job is to support what they're trying to achieve. Now, quite often, you run into limitations of what's possible on the current generation of hardware. So we have to steer them in a direction like, this would work, or it would work better if you went in this direction. But for the most part, our role is to support what the creative vision of what they're trying to achieve.
There is a perception, there has been a perception, that often games are the vision of one person. I won't name any because I'm not as into the games industry, but I know there are games on PlayStation and on Xbox where one person is credited as the visionary. In your experience, is that accurate?
Yeah, I've never worked on a game where there has been one person who kind of held the vision for everything. Most game development is an iterative process, and it takes prototyping a lot of stuff and experimenting with ideas, of which, you know, 95% don't work out, until you hit upon the thing that does work, and that's how you make progress.
But how do you know it works?
Well, that's the million-dollar question, isn't it? It works if it's positively received by the fans.
But you won't know. But when you're making it, how do you know it's working?
Yeah. I think the only way that we can do that is by playing the game ourselves. Most people who work in the games industry, especially on the creative side, are huge consumers of games as well as creators. So, I mean, it's like, how does a writer know his book is good, right?
I don't know the answer to that one either. Yeah. I hope you do.
Yeah, you have to consume a lot of content, and you have to have taste, and you have to know what kind of thing you're trying to achieve when you're putting this thing together.
So where did the idea that there is one person behind these games, because there are games out there, you know, so-and-so's something. That's been the way for quite a long time.
Yeah, I think there's a couple of sources where that could come from. The games industry used to be the games that we would make used to be much smaller scale. Mm. So when you're on a much smaller team, I think it is possible for one person to sort of be the creative vision driving it. I definitely don't think that's true of most AAA games that you see today.
So what's AAA mean?
AAA is like the top, the premium prestige games.
Oh, so the EAs and the Microsoft releases, that's...
Yeah, okay. Yeah. Like,
sorry, not... You know, familiar with the games industry.
Right. And so games that are a tail end of a long franchise, I can see them still being attributed to the original person who came up with the concept, you know, but I guarantee you that they're not pulling all of the strings on everyone working on the game in modern games, because the teams are just so huge. And the other way it comes from, I think, you know, it's hard to keep track of all of the people. You know, games take hundreds of people to produce these days. So it's hard to pick. If you're going to pick one person, you're going to pick the figurehead, the person who does all the press, And, you know, and I think in some cases, it is important to have a figurehead, but what that person really does, what their real role is to edit the ideas that the rest of the team produces. So the whole team produces ideas about what, how the game should work and what's going to fit and what's not going to fit. The figurehead sort of edits it in the sense that they decide whether or not it fits in the puzzle of the game as a whole. But it's not like the creative person comes up with all of the ideas themselves, far from it.
And traditionally, you were saying that traditionally the creative person often was an engineer, so they would program their own games. But in more, let's say, recent times when the game's budgets are in the tens of millions, is that creative person often an engineer, or are they being pulled from other industries like film or TV or writing or books at this stage?
Yeah, our field now is highly specialized. So, you know, it's not even like there are designers. Like there are technical designers, there are level designers, there are people, and the artists, there are environment artists, there are character artists, there are people who just rig characters so that they can be animated, but they don't actually animate them.
So what does that mean to rig?
It's setting up a skeleton so that the joints fold in the correct way. And, you know, the same is true of programmers. There are gameplay programmers. There are programmers who cross over to being designers. There are tech programmers. There are graphics programmers. And it's all because it's specialized because there's so much depth to every one of these job roles that it's not possible to be good at everything anymore.
Something I noticed with a lot of games as well, I recently enough got a PlayStation, so I'm seeing, I don't use it very often, but I see things like an Unreal Engine or a something else engine. How much of an influence are these third-party engines that big games companies seem to be employing having?
Yeah, the engines, I definitely come from an era where every game used to write its own engine from scratch. You know, you start with an empty C++ file and start typing and out pops a game at the end. But it's an economy thing in the sense that I was figuring this out actually before we started. There are probably thousands of man years invested in the Unreal Engine. If you think about a team of like 50 to 100 people working for 15 to 20 years on this thing, you know, that's thousands of man years. And so it's not possible to create that from scratch every time. Now, so it's fantastic that they make these engines available either to license or, in the case of Unreal Engine, they give it away for free. And it's actually empowered a lot of people who otherwise couldn't do the heavy burden of tech to get games up and running. So now it's actually possible for anyone to download this thing and start making games in it, and you don't really hit the technical challenges until you try to do something that the engine is not capable of out of the box. So from an engineer's perspective, it saves us reinventing the wheel every time we start a new game. We don't have to write the physics engine over again. We don't have to write the input handling over again. We actually get to focus on what makes this game different from other games. So in a lot of ways, modern game development is taking an engine that's sort of generic and you can kind of make any game in it, and it's taking it in a direction. So you're trying to achieve something that perhaps the game engine doesn't do out of the box, and that's kind of the role that we play these days.
Something that's slightly different, again, from my type of engineering to the gaming engineering is the concept of prototyping. If I'm doing a prototype, it's one tiny thing. I'll typically create a console app and I'll run it. But in gaming, prototyping has a much more broad use.
Yeah, prototyping is basically the only way you can discover whether the game is going in the right direction. And like I said before, you throw out 95% of the things that you try. So it's an act of discovery in a lot of senses. You know, it's not like we know what we're making before we begin. We have to try things. There's an old saying in the industry, made four games and shipped one.
And is that a common thing?
Yeah, I mean, I don't see how you can achieve it otherwise. I mean, if you're making something that's like a clone of another game, then all of the design is kind of figured out for you, but nobody does that, right? So you're trying to do something new, and usually there's some kind of new mechanic involved or new rendering technique involved or something, and you have to experiment in order to see what works and what doesn't work. And, you know, on top of that, technology is always moving forward, especially in the field of VR, virtual reality. There are some things that are possible and there are some things that are not possible. And I don't think anyone has really gotten a handle on like the best way to interact with things in VR yet, or the best way to move characters around the world, since you can't physically walk around.
One of the challenges with prototyping you must face is if you're the game developer and you're testing your prototype and you've played it 100 times, how do you know it's even still any fun? You know, you're obviously sharing it amongst your peers, and there's sometimes an element of groupthink in companies, but that can be okay if what you're shipping again is a business related product, where as long as it works, it's fine. But you have to all work together, not insult each other, try out other people's ideas, and still kind of criticize in a productive way.
Yeah, and you're right, there is groupthink sometimes, and so a lot of companies bring in external playtesters, and they place a high value on people who've not played the game yet. In fact, some teams even keep some of their own team members clean. Let's say there's a tutorial or an intro or something like that. Somebody who works exclusively on making movies for the game is not necessarily going to have played it, and sometimes that's like a prized thing, because then you can get like new eyes on the intro to see whether it effectively teaches the player how to play the game.
We see it in film, a lot of sequels, and I think we're seeing it now in a lot of games. Is it fair to say that a lot of companies, when they're putting down tens, or maybe are games hitting hundreds of millions of dollars?
Yes, definitely.
Is it fair to say then that there's a strong impetus to just make sequels because there's a market and generally that's what people like doing?
Yeah, I think it's complicated. I think coming up with something brand new is very expensive. You know, it's you throw away most of the work that you do before you hit upon the thing that is going
to
work.
You're back to, again, trying out three and holding on to
one.
Yeah.
There's also a player expectation. You know, there's certain conventions in games that gamers expect. So if you're reinventing a system like how the camera works or how aiming works, then you've really got to be prepared to invest time in teaching the player how to do the new behavior, the new mechanic. Otherwise, players are going to expect the game to work in a certain way.
Do games companies ever hold things back knowing that there's going to be a sequel and... oh, you know, we have this really good thing we could include, but we'll wait for part two?
Yes, but not in an evil way.
Okay.
I think the way games get shipped is by cutting features and controlling scope. And so I think game developers in general are pretty aspirational people, and they have a million great ideas that would be great to put in the game, but you can't spend 20 years developing every game. So there's just not time. So in a lot of cases, a feature will be cut so that the game can ship at all. And it's usually a bunch of features will be cut so that the game can ship at all. And then if you're lucky and the game is a hit and it becomes the beginning of a franchise, then in later revisions, you can go back in and polish out those features. But it's never the case that there's a feature that's done that completely works in the game and it's cut. I think any feature that's feasible and polished, we would include.
In, again, the non-gaming industry, companies often look to what other companies are doing to get inspiration and to copy, for want of a better term. Is that something that games companies do too?
There's a lot of sharing in our industry anyway.
Sharing, we call it. Okay.
A lot of game designers talk about various ideas. There are multiple games conferences every year. I think probably the most famous is the GDC, the Game Developers Conference. But there are dozens, if not hundreds, of conferences in the US and around the world. And it's pretty interesting how open people are with the technologies that they develop. And I think in a way, that's the only way that our industry as a whole can progress. You know, it's if everyone was developing siloed and in secret, then there wouldn't be this sort of like all boats rising. And I don't think you would get things like the Unreal Engine or the Unity Engine, and I don't think that you would get conventions in VR and controller usage that players can get used to. Like, all of those things are platforms on which to build the next level of experience. So I don't even think that the sharing that occurs results in blandness. I think it just rises everyone up so that they can try new things.
I had an indie games developer on the podcast, Trevor Stricker. He's local to Boston as well. And he made a comment, and I didn't quite understand it at the time, but a mechanic of a game cannot be copyrighted in any way. Can you explain that one, why that's important?
Yeah, copyright...
Or protected, maybe.
Yeah, copyright pretty much just covers the literal expression of the code or the art. There are software patents too, but I think in the culture of most developers, at least in the games industry, software patents are viewed as inhibiting innovation. It's a problem, and there are certainly problems with companies that clone games out there and steal the ideas. And yeah, I don't really know what to do about that, but I wouldn't want to go to a place where nobody can take inspiration from other people's work. I mean, the basis of all of the progress we make is by standing on the shoulders of the people who came before us.
But again, the kind of games you're working on, they're such big budgets that I suppose this problem is more for the small games like phone games, tablet games, because it can be so quickly replicated.
Right.
Once a team has hit upon something that's good, you've thrown out the three bad prototypes and you've got the one that you have decided is fun. What happens after that?
Yeah, game development has a kind of life cycle, I guess, like most software products, but it's kind of very different for the activities that the team performs in every stage. So the prototyping kind of sets the direction for the team. And after you've got prototypes, after you've got some mechanics that work, there's this phase where you do a big build out of everything in the game, where you're trying to get all systems online. So in some cases, what you're trying to do is get some small piece of the game online, which they call a vertical slice. And in other cases, you're trying to get the entire game stood up so you can play it end to end. And the point of that is, once you can play the game end to end, you can see pretty clearly what's missing from the whole experience.
Would that be potentially end to end without fancy graphics, without fancy sounds, things like that?
Yeah, and some missions might just not even have functionality. It might just say you start the mission and congratulations, okay, You've completed the mission. But there's a lot of infrastructure because, you know, games are huge. There are tons of art assets and content. And so we have to stream stuff in and out of memory. We have to manage the limited memory that's available. And so just even getting things to stream in and out when you need them to is like a huge challenge. And once you've got to that stage, then that's when you've got an entire game, which then you can begin a whole new round of critique upon. You know, then you get to see really how terrible this thing that you've created is. And so you kind of begin iteration again. Then the next phase we reach is what I like to call the doldrums. I don't know whether this is an official part of the software life cycle of a game that people plan for, but in my experience, every big game hits this, where you kind of get these morale issues on the team. You know, you've got a game, you can play it end to end, but it sucks.
And it sucks because it's not fun, it's not the whole experience.
Why is it not cohesive? It's not fun. Some parts don't work. Some parts are annoying. You know, it's kind of hard to figure out the subjective parts of the game development process. And so fighting through that is probably the toughest part. Like, a lot of people quit in those stages. And if you last it out, because, you know, it's your livelihood as well as your creative baby. It's also your livelihood. So if you're working on a game that feels like it's never going to come together, it can be pretty demoralizing. So game developers tend to be pretty hardy when it comes to that. They live with a long period where the game is not fun before something comes along to make it fun. And the thing that comes along is usually just this emergence. And I think this is what makes games so difficult to schedule, is how do you plan for when various different chains of events throughout the team. Like an artist might talk to a designer and come up with a good idea that works in place of an idea that doesn't work. Like, how do you schedule for that? You don't know how long that process is going to take. And this kind of speaks to the point of how there is no single creative person with a vision for the, whole game. Like, I don't think any one person can decide to fix that problem. It is really an emergent thing that happens on a bunch of different layers between a bunch of different people on the team talking. And then finally, you kind of get to more of a unified vision. And then after you've got that, then you get into the closing stage. So the closing stage is kind of my favorite part of the game. It's when all of the creative side of things have been figured out. You know what you're trying to make. You know what's going to go in the game, and you know what's going to be cut from the game. And then the challenge is just executing on it. So keep in mind that, like, by the time you've gotten to this point, you've done a lot of iteration. So there's a lot of technical debt in the software, and there's a similar kind of thing in the way the models are constructed, so they're not optimized. So you actually have to go to this. You have to take the thing that you've crafted, and turn it into something that is actually going to run at frame rate, that's actually going to run without crashing, that's going to load and not make the user wait too long for things to get loaded into memory. And you have to get all the bugs out and execute on the vision.
And when you say running at frame rate, it's that you're developing on things that are more powerful than the target machine?
Yeah, although a lot of games during development play at slower frame rates too, and game developers just put up with that, but consumers would not put up with it.
I see.
You know, and some of that is just like pragmatism. It takes a lot longer to make an art asset, for example, that's highly optimized. And so if you go into this endeavor with the premise that you're going to throw out most of the art that you create, then there is no point in optimizing the things that you're going to just throw away anyway. Like, that's just a waste of time. So quite often, the art assets that get you to the point where you know what the game is and you know it's going to be fun are not optimal. And then you have to go back and sometimes redo all of those assets to make them production quality.
And do you tend to keep the same engineers, the same teams who got the game to the sort of, okay, we know it's fun, it's kind of done, but it's not ready for product and release? Is it typically the same people that are going to push it to that point?
It can be, but usually it's different people. Usually people either show a flair for prototyping or they show a flair for closing.
Yeah, because I can imagine you'd be tired of it to some degree. They just want to move on.
Yeah, tired of it, too close. But also, you know, some people are inspired by trying new stuff every day.
Yeah.
And other people are inspired by solving challenges like, this is what they want. How are we going to get it done? And I think most of the work that we do falls into that latter category. It's like helping people to ship their game. How do you take something that's like an aspirational idea and turn it into something that you can actually download and play on your console or PC?
This is obviously a very tricky question to answer, but how long do these AAA games take to make now? From, I don't know, code line one, even though you've got your engines or whatever, yeah, to pushing out that release?
Yeah, even a small game takes at least a year to make. And
that's a small console game or a small...
Yeah, like a polished game, you know, yeah. Like not a hobbyist game. So yeah, at least a year. A lot of games take more, 2, 3, 5 years if you're doing something experimental. And yeah, a 5-year game with a team of 100 plus people, that's where it starts to cost a lot of money.
5 years, 100 people. And that's the state we're at the moment.
Yeah, yeah. And I think things are starting to change. A lot of the vision behind what we had when we started this company was just the realization that a team of 100 people cannot make agile decisions. You can't turn a team of 100 people in a new direction based like you have to do during the prototyping stage. It's much better to have a small team doing your prototypes. But then it takes a lot of people to ship a game. So what do you do? If you run a games company, you either go through cycles of hiring people and laying them off in between games, or you try to make enough games it's staggered so that people have something to move on to. But you know, I can tell you that making one game is really difficult. Making like 5 games at the same time, that's incredibly difficult.
And budgets as well, that would be very, very difficult.
Yes. So I think that's part of what we had in mind when we started our company, is that because the amount of staff that it takes to work on a game and make a good game is not constant, we see this need for companies to be able to hire in experts when they need them, and then they're not on their payroll when they don't need them.
And so coming back to disbelief, what are some of the common engineering challenges that you would help not a Microsoft, because you said you're more of a supplementary team to them, but to a company where there's frame rate issues or something?
Yeah, quite often it's digging into what they're trying to achieve. The upside and the downside of rendering engines is you can, of engines like Unreal and Unity, is you can do a lot of stuff, but there's lots of different, they're very configurable. There's lots of different ways to achieve the same thing. And quite often the way that you arrive at by iterating on your game is not the optimal way to do it. So it's quite often talking to the content creators about what they're actually trying to achieve, and then figuring out a way to do that efficiently. And in the case of VR, the frame rates have to be so much higher, you know?
They have to be, someone told me a really high number, but I don't remember.
Yeah, so a normal game, like a normal console game from years ago that's not too fast paced could run at 30 frames per second. And a Twitch game, like a fighting game or something like that.
Sorry, a Twitch game.
Twitching
your fingers.
Twitching your fingers.
Okay, sorry.
Yeah, like
I'm showing my ignorance.
Like an arcade reactive game, like a fighting game.
Yeah.
Would have to run at 60 frames per second. And VR, what we're really aiming for is 90 frames per second, so that it literally comes down to, if the player moves their head, then you have to update everything that they're looking at. You have to basically re-render every pixel to give them a new viewpoint. Otherwise, their vision sort of drags as they move around. And so frames per second is actually, you know, since this is an engineering-focused podcast, is actually not something we use all that often in the role that we play, because that's a 1/x relationship. And so quite often we think about the frame times in milliseconds. So in a 30 hertz game, you have 33 milliseconds in order to do all of the work that you need to do. In a 60 hertz game, you have 16.66 milliseconds to get all of the work done. And then in a 90 hertz game, you have 11 milliseconds to do all of that same work. And, you know, that's the kind of thing. This is why technology is a challenging factor in what we do. Some of the techniques that apply to 30 hertz games, you can do heavy post-processing. You can do a bunch of graphics effects, especially post-processing effects, that take multiple milliseconds to execute to put that extra kind of polish on the visuals of the game. A lot of the techniques don't even translate to VR, because you literally just cannot do that processing in time to get the frame done in time. So this kind of speaks to the second part of what's going to work and what's not going to work. So quite often that's the consulting we do with our customers. Like, this idea that you've got might be excellent, but on the current generation of hardware that we have available, it is never going to work, and you could do this thing instead. And there's kind of a feedback loop between what's possible and what they're trying to achieve.
And disbelief is Cambridge and another
yeah, city? We have an office in Cambridge and an office in Chicago, Illinois.
And are most people engineers, ex-games industry like yourself?
Everyone in the company is an engineer right now. And yeah, we don't have any artists or creative or anything like that. I think this speaks to the point I made earlier. We're not really aspirational towards making our own game. Like, our passion is really the technology. So helping other people ship their games is what we do.
All right, it's getting kind of late here. So any notes before we wrap up, Steve?
I would like to mention that Disbelief is looking for software engineers. You don't necessarily have to have a video games or game development background, but you do have to like the really low-level technical challenges. If you're prepared to toil hard behind the scenes and not be able to point at a game and point at the rocket launcher and say, I made that, it's more like, because the game doesn't crash, you know your job is done. It's very technical, but you get to mix with creative people, and you get to face a bunch of different types of challenges. So it's pretty exciting work.
And you're hiring in both locations?
We're hiring in both locations. And like I said, games industry experience is not a prerequisite. We're hiring at all levels, from senior through to junior. We will take people who are straight out of school, as long as they have an aptitude and a passion for the kind of technologies that we work on.
Steve Elmore, thank you very much for your time this evening.
No problem. Thank you.
Music was Returned by Nisi 23 from the album 11 and 12, and the closing music was Bon Bon by Hicham Chahidi.